A lot of good comments on I saw a lot of good comments that students that took the exam had on the QBank, and they said it was the most like what their exam was of anything they ever ran across. So apparently it's got good reviews from people that have taken the exam. So it's a good good product testing. All right. Genetic disease, guys. This patient, wherever their sun-exposed area, would be predisposed to all the skin cancers, basal cell, squamous cell, and melanomas. It's an autosomal recessive disease. Name me. Xeroderma pigmentosum. What's the defect? DNA repair enzymes. Now, there's another group of diseases that are listed in the notes that are also DNA repair enzyme things. Remember, BRCA1, BRCA2 is involved in that. So is P53, isn't it? Splices out those defects. But they are called chromosome instability syndromes. They include things like Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, Bloom syndrome, ataxia, telangiectasia. What's another one? Fanconi syndrome. All of these have problems with DNA repair. And they commonly ask these on examination. So I just wanted to mention that. There's a basic rule of thumb. It doesn't always hold. From upper lip up is basal cell country. From lower lip down is squamous cell. Okay, so I will show you when we do GI, I'll show you a lesion on the lower lip, and I'm going to ask you, what odds are, what is it? And you should say squamous cell carcinoma. If I had one on the upper lip, odds are would be basal cell. Remember that one that was on the inside of the nose was above lip. So a crateriform lesion of upper lip and higher is basal cell country, lower lip and lower is squamous cell. Okay, this basic rule of thumb. There are many exceptions to that, but it's reasonable. Reasonable. So why am I showing this keloid again with the same kind of lesion that we saw on the skin that we call the squamous cell carcinoma? Why am I doing that? Did I make a mistake? Now remember we were talking about squamous cell carcinomas and third degree burns and squamous cell carcinomas developing in areas of drainage from let's say a sinus and this ulcer that doesn't heal with antibiotics, you know. So in other words, where there's constant irritation and there's divisions of cells related to that irritation is always a greater risk for cancer. And it just turns out that the most common cancer would be squamous cancer in those areas because you're dealing with squamous epithelium, not glandular epithelium. This does not hold for scar cancers, by the way, of the lung. Most scar cancers that relate to old TB scars to something like that are adenocarcinomas, not squamous. It just holds to things on the skin, okay? That this relationship with burns and draining sinus tracts, that's squamous cell carcinoma. Who can tell me the only bacteria associated with cancer? Helicobacter pylori, name the two cancers. Adenocarcinoma and low-grade malignant lymphomas. Mm-hmm. Two cancers for that sucker. God, my amazing little organism. Guys, you better listen up. I know for a fact this picture was on the exam because someone almost had a conniption. Just went, ah! What's the matter with you? I had that on my nose! I mean, that's... We might have had someone a little bit more manic than me that day. Okay? So I know for a fact that that says on there. Grade and stage, guys. You better listen real careful. Big time. What's the grade of the cancer? Well, the grade of a cancer is what's it look like, okay? And if you can identify what it is because it's doing something like making keratin or making glands, then it's well differentiated, another term, low grade. If you look at something, which would be most of the things that you look at, it's anaplastic, high grade, poorly differentiated. In other words, you can't tell by looking at it under the microscope what it is. That's grade. That's a grade term. Okay, let me see if you can grade these tumors now. Can you tell me what the origin of this is? It's squamous. Why? Because you have these beautiful keratin pearls there. And so because you identified it, is that a low-grade or a high-grade cancer? Low-grade. I want you to look at that. What do you see? You see gland-like spaces, right? So this is an adenocarcinoma. You identified it as malignant glandular cells. So is that low-grade or high-grade? Low-grade. Very good. So grade is what it looks like. Now listen careful. Stage. Now I don't want you to forget this, please. I want you to remember the T is in toy, N is in Nancy, M is in machine system. Because here's what it does. This is the most common staging system. It goes from least important to most important. Now, here's where your problem is. You think that when, let's say, take breast cancer. You got a breast cancer, and they say that the low axillary nodes are involved. Okay? You think that that's the worst thing of all. No, no, no. No, no. That's the end part of TNM. What's even worse than that is if it's outside the lymph nodes, like bone, lung, or liver. So just because it goes to the lymph nodes doesn't mean that that's the most important prognostic factor. So T stands for the size of the tumor, okay? That thing, that's what it basically is. T stands for tumor, how big is the sucker? A magic number seems to be 2 centimeters. If a tumor is over 2 centimeters, it generally has a chance of metastasizing. Whenever you look at staging things for different organs, 2 seems to always come out. So just remember 2. N stands for nodes. So that's the next most important thing for prognosis is nodes. The third is M. That's metastasis outside of nodes. So what is the most important prognostic factor for cancer? Is it grade or stage? Stage. And in staging, what's most important? The size of the tumor, whether it has lymph node involvement, or metastasis to other areas? Metastasis. Now, let me give you an example on someone's boards and how they screwed it up. So they described their prostate cancer, and they said, which of the following is the worst prognosis? And they said, first, prostate cancer limited to the prostate. And then they said, went into the seminal vesicles. Then they said, went into the wall of the bladder. Then they said, went to the lymph nodes around the bladder. Then they said, went to bone. There you go. What do you think the ding-dong picked? The lymph nodes. He picked that because he didn't know the T and M system. Missed it. Just remember T and M, you can't get screwed up. If they don't mention something outside of the lymph nodes, then the lymph nodes would be the most important. But if they mention liver or bone or something like that, my God, that is right. That's stage 4 by definition. Okay? Don't forget that. Very, very important. Good Lord in heaven. So let's look at this. This is a colon cancer. That's a lymph node. Okay? So what's the most important? The size of this tumor or that lymph node involvement? The lymph node involvement. Now, let's say I said that there was also a similar focus of cancer in the liver. Then what? The liver is the most important prognostic factor. Very good. All right. Host defenses. You've had immunology. You know what the most important host defense we have? That little friend, the cytotoxic CD8 T cell. That is the numero uno most important host defense system we've got. Now we have other things, macrophages, natural killer cells. It even says what they do, natural kill. Okay, the natural killer cells, they can do that. Antibodies by type 2 hypersensitivity can do it. So there's a number of other mechanisms, but numero uno is CD8 cytotoxic T cells. Why they do rounds every day looking for altered class 1 antigens? And whenever you have a neoplastic cell, those class 1 antigens are altered. Boy, when that cytotoxic T cells, it gets very interested in that. Whoosh, kills that cell. Okay, that puts out perforin. That's the signal for who? Caspases to do what? Apoptotically kill that cell. Remember, it has to be a signal. Signal to who? The proteases, which they call caspases. And then they start breaking down the nucleus, screwing up the mitochondria, and then the cell dies. Without any inflammatory infiltrate whatsoever. Cachexia, you need to know on that cause, and that's tumor necrosis factor alpha. It's irreversible. Once you see this, a poor patient with disseminated cancer just beginning to go into a catabolic state, you can give them total parenteral nutrition until it comes out of their ears. They will not get their muscle mass and stuff back. It's all over. That's due to tumor necrosis factor alpha. Hematology. Lots of different things, hematologic causes of anemia are present in malignancy. So the most common anemia in malignancy, most common is anemia chronic disease, which we'll discuss today. Okay, that's the overall most common, but there could be other ones. Synthetic colon cancer, for example, could be, if you remember, left side obstructs, right side bleeds. If you have a right-sided colon cancer, then iron deficiency would be more common. Also, what if you metastasized to bone and replaced all the bone marrow? That could be a mechanism. Or use chemotherapy drugs, you know, that are cell cycle specific or non-specific, and you wipe out the stinking marrow. You know, there's another cause of it. They can have autoimmune mechanisms with certain types of cancers. But overall, most commonly, it's anemia chronic disease. Most patients that have disseminated cancer are hypercoagulable. What does that mean? That means they have a tendency for forming clots. Of course, this is a classic example. The dude that has a painless jaundice, he's got, let's say, a left supraclavicular node. I'm going to throw that in as a distractor for you. Has light-colored stools. And he has this peculiar lesions in the vein that seem to jump from one part of his body to the next. Okay, what's that? That's Trousseau sign. That's superficial migratory thrombophlebitis in a patient with carcinoma of the head of the pancreas. Pancreatic cancers can also go to the left supraclavicular node. They ask the Trousseau sign very commonly. They don't say Trousseau sign. They just describe this vascular problem in the veins that just kind of jumps from one place to the next. It's very pretty reasonably common. That's an example of a hypercoagulable state. Another thing we very commonly see with disseminated cancers, thrombocytosis, an elevated platelet count. I can't tell you how many times I've been asked to do bone marrows on patients and say, we need you to work up the cause of this thrombocytosis. And most of the time I can just do it from a hematology slip. I see if they have iron deficiency, then that's the cause of thrombocytosis. I see a scar over here, okay, fat splenectomy, okay? And then I look for anemias and stuff like that, if they have TB, that could be another cause. But when I can't find any obvious cause for thrombocytosis, I rule out myeloproliferative diseases and stuff like that. It's always cancer. 40% of all disseminated cancers are thrombocytosis. And you know, what I usually find that they missed is colon cancer. You want to know why? Didn't do a stool guaiac. I said, you do a stool guaiac in this patient? No. I think I'd do one. They do one. Positive. Colonoscopy. Cancer. That's the cause of thrombocytosis. Remember, guys, a stool guaiac is part of any normal physical exam. If it's not done, you have not done a complete exam. Remember that. Always. Fever. Most common cause of fever and malignancy is a gram-negative infection. Usually the gram-negatives are the hospital that you're in dying. E. coli, if you have an indwelling catheter. If you have a respirator, Pseudomonas aeruginosa. If you have an indwelling catheter, maybe in a vein or something like that, Staph aureus. But that's gram-positive. So most commonly they gram-negative. In fact, the most common cause of death in cancer is infection. Right, paraneoplastic syndromes. Very, very important, guys. Very, very important. Now, let me tell you what this is. These are signs, sometimes symptoms, that say that you may have an underlying cancer present. So they're kind of like little clues that something's going on in a patient. Now, why would this be important? Well, maybe if you recognize this clue, you can actually find that cancer before it's metastasized. Okay? So that's the key for knowing these things. Now listen carefully on this. The most common paraneoplastic syndrome is hypercalcemia. Now I'm going to present two mechanisms, and you're going to tell me which one classifies as paraneoplastic. Remember, the purpose of these things is to find some clue that will detect the cancer before it's spread. That's the basic thing that we're saying. All right, there's two mechanisms for hypercalcemia malignancy. One is you metastasize to bone, produce some kind of chemical, interleukin-1, prostaglandin E2, that activates osteoclast, produces lytic lesions in bone, voila, hypercalcemia. That's one. That's the most common. Two, it could be a couch potato cancer, like a renal adenocarcinoma or a squamous carcinoma of the mainstem bronchus that just sits there and makes parathormone-like peptide, and it just causes hypercalcemia to occur because it acts like parathormone and breaking bone down a little bit. Which one's paraneoplastic? The second one. And that's certainly not the most common one. Okay. Good. Right? These pretty much summarize, these pictures, all the important paraneoplastic syndromes. Okay. Now notice there's two lesions that are black here. And both of these, interestingly, are phenotypic markers for the same cancer, gastric adenocarcinoma. Usually this lesion, this black lesion, is under the arm, not always. This is called acanthosis, finish it, nigricans, okay? And this is called seborrheic keratosis. Now, don't go bananas on this, okay? Because a single seborrheic keratosis doesn't mean a hill of beans. I got a pile of them under my axilla, which I'm not going to show you, okay? But, I mean, they're there. These are not even neoplasms, guys. But here's the thing. When they suddenly develop, like overnight, there's crops of these, you know, boom, all of a sudden, they were there yesterday, they weren't there yesterday, now they're there. That's called the lesser Trelot sign. when you get multiple outcroppings of these things, that is a phenotypic marker for gastric adenocarcinoma. So it's kind of easy to remember because there are two black lesions that are markers for an underlying gastric adenocarcinoma. I know some of you are pretty sharp and you know that acanthosis nigricans associated with other things. I know you know about the insulin receptor deficiency related to diabetes, also men syndromes. So it's a phenotypic marker for a lot of things, but most commonly gastric adenocarcinoma. Diagnosis? Clubbing. Better diagnosis. Hypertrophic. I forget the other part of it. Hypertrophic. whatever. It's an inflammation underneath in the bone. Periostitis. Okay? And it's the inflammation of the underlying bone that stimulates increased soft tissue development around it and produces the clubbing. So it's hypertrophic osteoarthropathy. That's what it is. That's what produces clubbing. Now, clubbing isn't always associated with malignancy. You can see with bronchiectasis, inflammatory bowel disease. But if it were to be a malignancy, what would it more likely be? Primary lung cancer. Okay. Now, this is the least common collagen vascular disease, but the one most commonly associated with an underlying cancer. I'll give you a hint. They have an elevation in serum CK. Dermatomyositis is the answer. Some of you should have recognized this as raccoon eyes, the so-called heliotrope or raccoon eyes of dermatomyositis. Okay, and that's an inflammation of skin and muscle. And so they got myositis, which releases serum CK. High association with leukemias and cancer, lung cancer, lymphomas, etc. Anybody know what the name of the little patches over the knuckles and stuff like that are called? Goldtrin's patches. Dermatomyositis. Okay, now we have some vegetations here on the mitral valve. They're sterile. These are associated with mucus-producing cancers like colon cancer. Okay, it's a paraneoplastic syndrome. This is called Marantic endocarditis. And they are benign. I mean, they're not not benign, but they're not infected. There's no infection. It just basically seems to be associated with mucus-secreting colon cancers, Marantic vegetations. Can they embolize? Sure. In fact, that was a board question. I mean, ability to embolize. Sure, because they're pretty big. I mean, you can see those chipping off there. Now, would you need some history to separate that from rheumatic fever? Oh, you bet you would. Okay, it looks very similar to that. In fact, it looks like it's right along the margin of the valve. Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. Except the history would relate more to colon cancer than rheumatic fever, polyarthritis and stuff like that. Okay, they would be giving this versus this. Okay, I don't think I would be thinking infective endocarditis with this because it's too even along there. Infective endocarditis get these huge vegetations at different places. Lehman Sachs, not a chance. Lehman Sachs endocarditis vegetations are all over the place, including down there, no way. So the only thing you could potentially confuse that with is rheumatic fever, that's it. Okay, so those are some of your paraneoplastic syndromes. Now the rest is up to you. Ready? Okay, there's another Marantic vegetation. Okay, these are little snippets here, and you're going to tell me what the cancer is and where it's located. Ready? Okay, hyponatremia or Cushing's? Lung cancer. Smell cell carcinoma. Hormones. ADH for that. ACTH for that. Small cell cancer. What's another thing that's unusual about small cells? They're output tumors, S100 antigen positive, neural crest origin, neural secretory granules on electron microscopy. Okay, hypercalcemia or secondary polycythemia? Wrong. Renal adenocarcinoma. Okay, renal adenocarcinoma. Renal adenos can make parathormone-like peptide, and they also can make erythropoietin. Okay, about hypoglycemia or secondary polycythemia? Hepatocellular carcinoma. Okay, they can make erythropoietin, there's your polycythemia, and they can make an insulin-like factor, there's your hypoglycemia. Okay, how about, this is the hardest one actually, how about hypocalcemia or Cushing's? I'm going to give you a hint. It can be an autosomal dominant variety of this, and this particular tumor is one of the rare tumors where the tumor marker can be converted into amyloid. The answer is medullary carcinoma of the thyroid. And what was that tumor marker that can be converted into amyloid? Calcitonin. There you go. This is the way you ask your ectopic hormone syndrome, guys. If you're sitting there with your fingers in your ear, Okay? This is the way they ask them. Okay? So this is all memorization. There's nothing that you can't think your way. You can only one thing you can think your way into. And that is, it's pretty obvious to me that a kidney cancer can produce erythropoietin. I mean, that is not. That's just an absolute no-brainer. All the other stuff, you just have to know. Just absolutely memorize it. So there's no other way. Let's see how you do on tumor markers. Okay, what two tumor markers do you always get when you have a male with a testicular cancer, please? Alpha fetoprotein and HCG. Now, what is alpha fetoprotein in a testicular cancer a marker for? What kind of cancer? Yolk sac tumor. What's another name for that? Endodermal sinus tumor. Now, think of this, guys. Think of this. Alpha fetoprotein. Doesn't it sound young? Fetoprotein? Did you know that alpha fetoprotein really is the albumin of the fetus? That's really what it is. And so tumors in kids, like of the ovary in a girl or of a boy, are most commonly yolk sac tumors. Okay? Alpha fetoprotein. You know, young kid? And even the name sounds young. Alpha fetoprotein. Okay, you also know it's associated with hepatocellular carcinoma. Okay, that's the tumor marker you would want to get for that. You also know open neural tube defects, it's increased. You also know that you have to be on folate before you're pregnant to prevent open neural tube defects. And you also know that in Down syndrome, alpha-fetoprotein down is decreased. Those are all the facts that you need to know about alpha-fetoprotein. I want you to find for me a marker for a malignancy of bone that's associated with a monoclonal spike. Bench Jones protein, and what are we talking about? What disease? Multiple myeloma. What is Bench Jones protein? It's the light chain of the immunoglobulin. Very good. Okay. I want you to find me the tumor marker for prostate cancer. PSA. Is it specific for prostate cancer? No. Why? Because it can be increased in hyperplasia. But is it sensitive? Yes. But is it specific? No. Is it increased if you do a rectal examination? Absolutely not. Anyone that taught you otherwise is an idiot. Okay? Simply, they're an idiot. Want to know why? It's not an enzyme. If it was prostatic acid phosphatase, of course. This is an antigen, guys. It's actually within the actual cell. There is no way that you increase it with a rectal exam. No way. A lot of internists teach you, the PSA, never do a rectal exam before you're going to get a PSA. Bullcrap. Doesn't affect it whatsoever. Now, if it was prostatic acid phosphatase, yes, it would. They're kind of confusing with that. Okay? Please don't fall for that mistake. Okay. How about breast cancer, surface-derived, CA-125. Okay, how about, which one did I say? Ovarian cancer or breast? Oh, breast, no. That would be 15-3. How about ovarian cancer, CA-125? 19-9, they don't ask. PSA alpha-1. CEA. How about carcinoembryonic antigen? What's that for? Colon cancer. But we also use it in small cell, and we also use it in breast. Mainly colon cancer. Do you know it can be part of an immune complex? You can get CEA, anti-CEA, immune complexes which deposit in the kidney and produce nephrotic syndrome. Name the type of nephrotic syndrome, please. Is it minimal change disease or lipoid nephrosis? Is it focal segmental glomerulosclerosis? Or is it diffuse membranous glomerulonephritis? Which one is it? Diffuse membranous glomerulonephritis. When we get to kidney, we'll find out that a good percentage of the nephrotic syndromes in adults, well, the most common overall cause is diffuse membranous glomerulonephritis, but a good percentage of those are related to malignancy. And one of the most common malignancy is colon cancer, because CEA could be the antigen part of an immune complex and end up depositing in the glomeruli. Okay, if you thought a woman had a trophoblastic tumor or a mole, what marker would you get? Beta-HCG. Very good. Very good. Okay. I gave my last slide to my buddy that's doing the neoplasia lectures, and I couldn't find another one, so I'm going to just go from what I remember as the last part of the notes. You ready? What's the most common primary cancer? All right, I'm going to word it this way. Primary tumor of the brain in kids? The answer is a cerebellar cystic astrocytoma. Now, here's what you were taught. You were taught medulloblastoma. Wrong. You didn't listen to the way he asked the question. I said, what's the most common primary tumor? I didn't say whether it was benign or malignant. See, all astrocytomas are benign. Okay? So the most common actual tumor of the brain is, primary tumor of the brain, is a cerebellar tumor derived from astrocytes. Now, if I worded it this way, what's the most common primary cancer of the brain in a kid? Then what would the answer be? Medulloblastoma, and again, that also derives from the cerebellum. Big mistake. You see it wrong in lots of different books. You probably said, well, how do you know I'm right? Because I check the right books. I go and I read New England Journal of Medicine. I deal with brain tumors and also the literature on this thing. So I'm correct in what I'm saying. In fact, it's not even close. Cerebellar astrocytomas are way, way more common than medulloblastomas, but they're benign. And medulloblastoma. Now, what's the most common... What are some other common childhood tumors? What is the most common childhood cancer? Leukemia. What leukemia specifically? Acute lymphoblastic leukemia. The second group mainly is central nervous system tumors, and we already know that one. And then right after that, we get into things like neuroblastomas, very, very common, adrenal medulla. And then we have Burkitt's lymphomas right up there also, B-cell. Ewing sarcoma, it's a tumor of bone. Remember the onion skinning type of calcifications that you see with that. Another big one is the embryonal rhabdomyosarcoma. Those are the kind of the childhood ones. You don't really need to know. Maybe you basically need to know what's the most common of them. Leukemia, ALL. Okay. Now let's deal with adults. Okay, let's deal with incidence. I didn't say cancer kill. I said incidence, so cancer. Women, what's your number one cancer? Breast. What's your second? Lung. What's your third? Okay, men, what's our first? Prostate, second. Third. Good. Notice that colon's third all the time. All right, now let's talk about cancer killers. Men and women. Okay, let's go back to men. Second, prostate, women. Breast, third, men. Woman. Trick question. What's the second most common cancer and cancer killer in men and women combined? Colon cancer. There you go. Colon cancer is. When you put the two of them together, both, remember, we both have colons. So even though they were third for the individual sex, when you put us, lump us together, then the second most common overall cancer and cancer killer is a colon cancer. When you lump us together. I actually did the math on it. I looked up, put all the numbers and added them together, and it was true. That's why from age 50 on, you should have a rectal exam and a stool gliac, and then get a flexible SIG and or colonoscopy, depending on your risk. Because after 50, the most common cause of colon cancer of positive stool gliac is colon cancer. Your differential is colon cancer, colon cancer, colon cancer, colon cancer, colon cancer after 50. Really? Then what's the one after that one? Colon cancer. Okay? All right. PYN cancers, incidence, most common. Most common GYN cancer, leaving out breast. Okay, your choices are cervical, ovarian, and endometrial. Which is the most common of the three? Endometrial, numero uno. Numero two-o, that means number two in Spanish. I know it's not, don't worry about it. Some of you won't. Oh. What's number two? Ovarian. What's number three? Cervix. Why is cervical cancer the least common GYN cancer? Pap smear. Okay, now here's what some of you are thinking, if you're thinking at this particular time, 11:30. But no. Is it that late? No, that can't be right. Someone changed that. It is that late. Oh, my God. Okay. Here's what you thought, some of you. Say, I don't believe that. Because if you do a cervical pap and you pick up cervical cancer, wouldn't that increase the incidence? But what are you picking up? Why wasn't that a correct statement? That's correct if that was true. You're picking up cervical dysplasia. You pick up squamous cell dysplasia. That's not cancer. And you pick it up, and then what do? You usually end up doing a cervical cone or something like that, and the patient's cured. And because of cervical pap smears, the incidence of cervical cancer has gone down dramatically because you're picking up the precursor lesion. See, initially with mammography, the incidence of breast cancer increased because things you couldn't feel were now seen. So the incidence went up. Same thing with prostate cancer and PSA. Now they kind of leveled off. which means we need more sensitive techniques to pick them up now. Okay, now on cancer killers, GYN, numero uno, ovarian, numero two, cervical, numero three, endometrial. So the best way of remembering it, the most common one has the best prognosis. Endometrial is the most common, but it has the best prognosis. Okay. All right. What is the only known existing tumor vaccine? How many of you got vaccinated against hepatitis B? All of you better have your hand up, because if you don't, then you're crazy. Okay. Why? What is the most common infection transmitted by accidental needle stick in a hospital? Hepatitis B. You want to know why? The viral burden of hepatitis B in the blood is greater than any infection. In other words, it's even more so than HIV. All right. So you got three things that you're not going to get if you've been vaccinated. One, hepatitis B. What's the other hepatitis you're not going to get? D, because you need surface antigen. What's the other thing you're not going to get? Hepatocellular carcinoma related to hepatitis B-related cirrhosis. Three things. So it's the actually only existing tumor vaccine there is a vaccination with hepatitis B. Asked all the time. You just never think of it that way, but it's true. Did you know you can eradicate hepatocellular carcinoma as the most common cancer in the Far East by simple vaccination of every one of those people? You eradicate hepatocellular carcinoma. Okay, I think those are the key things that were in that last part there that's important. Let's start hematology. Okay, I'll let you kind of get yourself kind of situated, take a deep breath. Okay. This is the big nemesis of most medical students. You want to know why? There's all these different things there, and you get them all confused. I'm going to give you a key, which I already gave you. The way that you make hematology easy is big picture. Okay? Now, to me, big picture is something less simple. Microcytic anemias, MCV less than 80. Iron deficiency most common, anemia chronic disease, thalassemias, sideroblastic anemias. Boom. Macrocytic anemias, greater than 100. B12 folate deficiency, Pleiades, folate, and alcoholic. Normocytic anemias, low reticulocyte count, corrected, okay? Would be aplastic anemia, renal disease, that kind of thing. Normocytic anemia, corrected reticulocyte count, increased. Those are your hemolytic anemias, spherocytosis, sickle cell, G6PD deficiency, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, microangiopathic. That's the big picture. If you don't have all the different anemias down into a classification, you are screwed. Okay? You have to know that. That's your big picture. Because they always give you the mean corpuscular volume on the test. And so you can immediately classify it, guys. And that way it makes it so much easier. As opposed to which ones increased production, which ones, this. That's a terrible way of looking at it. Best way is to use the mean corpuscular volume as your mechanism for classifying anemias. And I'm telling you right now, it makes anemia extremely simple to diagnose, especially on an exam. Okay. Now, the reticulocyte count next to a complete blood cell count is your first step in the workup of any anemia. What is a reticulocyte? A reticulocyte is a young red blood cell. In exactly 24 hours, a reticulocyte will become a mature red blood cell with a biconcave disc. If you have an anemia, the reticulocyte count is important because it tells you where the problem is. Is it a problem in the bone marrow, in making the red blood cell, or is it a problem outside the bone marrow causing the problem? Well, the way you can determine that is a reticulocyte count. Because if the bone marrow was the problem, then your reticulocyte count would not be good. There would not be an appropriate response. What do I mean appropriate response? I mean you got a marrow that has RBC hyperplasia like I showed you in the slide yesterday. It's revved itself up, it's making lots of red blood cells, and it's going to should be putting some of those reticulocytes out a little bit prematurely. That means it's working, it's doing something to try to correct the anemia. Good! Okay, so it tells you whether the bone marrow is responding appropriately or not. Now, goodness gracious, guys, if I have blood loss right now, don't expect my reticulocyte count to be elevated in 24 hours. It takes at least 5 to 7 days before you can begin getting that response. Kind of like the kidneys dealing with bicarbonate and acid-base disorders. I mean, it just sits there for a couple days, and all of a sudden, did I get a message that I have to kind of increase my reclaiming of bicarb? Yes, I did. Okay, let's get going on it. It takes at least 3 to 4 days before you even begin thinking about it. Kind of sounds like a medical school student, a GO phase of the cell cycle. What's the thing that gets a medical student out of a GO phase of it? What's the stimulus for getting a GO phase medical student into the cell cycle, into G1? Test. They are in the cell cycle, and they stay in there like malignant cells. Test is over. Back in the GO phase. Back in the GO phase. Waiting for the next test for the stimulus. All right. It's a good way of remembering it now, right? See, I use funny things like that because you won't forget that. You won't forget that. Okay. So, if there's nothing wrong with the bone marrow, then I should have a good host of good reticulocyte response. If there is something wrong with the bone marrow, I don't. That's important, guys, because it may decide whether I'm going to do a bone marrow or not. Okay, if I have a good reticulocyte response, why in God's green earth would I want to do a bone marrow exam? Because there's nothing wrong with it. It's responding accurately. Okay. Okay, so that's going to determine what route I'm going to take. Okay. Now, here's the part that gets you. You have to correct the reticulocyte count for the degree of anemia. I won't explain why, just accept it. Otherwise, we'd have to spend 15 minutes explaining why. You have to correct it for the degree of anemia. And it's a very, very simple correction, guys. And here it is right here. Okay, basically, the corrected reticulocyte count is the hematocrit of the patient divided by 45, which is considered the normal. They don't change that number, whether it's a male or female. And they multiply that times the reticulocyte count that you're given. Okay, so here's an example. Let's say the patient's hematocrit is 15%, which, of course, is a very severe anemia. Okay, and let's say the reticulocyte count that was initially measured is 9%. Well, that's increased. Anything over 3 is actually considered increase. And so on the surface now, if you didn't do this correction, it would look like the bone marrow is responding appropriately because it's 9%. But you have to correct it for the degree of anemia. Okay, so let's do that. So 15 over 45 is 1/3, divided by 9 is 3. So actually, when we correct it for the anemia, we have a 3%. That's really what the corrected is. Okay, that's right at that marker for saying good response. So 3% or greater, good response. 3% or less, bad response. So it's basically saying, yeah, that's a reasonable response. Okay, that's going on in the patient. Okay? Now, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go here. I want to show you that what a reticulocyte looks like because it's on boards. Okay, this is a reticulocyte. Okay, is that the way they look with a regular right Giemsen stain? Nope, you've got to do a special stain to see these little black filaments in there. In fact, those are RNA filaments. And because they're RNA filaments, that means that the reticulocyte is still synthesizing hemoglobin. So in that 24 hours, about 25% of the hemoglobin that normally should be in a mature cell is being synthesized. That's pretty interesting. And so you need RNA filaments for that. So you cannot see these things without doing special stain. Okay, that's what they look like. So they look like little worms, little black worms in the red blood cell. There is no way you could confuse this with a Heinz body. I will show you what one of those look like this afternoon. No way. Okay, now I want you to look at these cells. Okay? This is not a special stain. This is a right Giemsen stain. You notice anything unusual about the color of those? What's the color? Bluish. We use the term polychromasia for that. Say that. Polychromasia. Okay. Why? What does this mean? These are younger red blood cells than these 24-hour-old reticulocytes. These are cells that still have that basophilia that they have before they become that are usually present in the mouth. These are not normally present in the peripheral blood. When we see them, it means that the bone marrow is really responding to this thing. It's even pushing some of these even younger cells out. And so whenever the board says polychromasia present, they're talking about these cells. And these cells take 2 to 3 days before they become a mature RBC. Now, why is this important to you? Well, first of all, because they ask it on boards. And second of all, we have to make an additional correction. Why? Well, when we're working up an anemia and we do a corrected reticulocyte count, we want to know how is that bone marrow responding right now in this day. We're not interested in what's going to happen 2 to 3 days from now. We're interested in what's happening right now. See, here's the problem. When we do the reticulocyte stain, these dudes are going to have RNA filaments in them too, and they're going to be counted in the reticulocyte count and falsely elevated. We don't want these dudes in there because these things take 2 to 3 days before they become a mature RBC. We want these dudes in there. That's what we want. So these dudes are screwing up our reticulocyte count. So how do we factor them out? Very simple. Divide by 2. Okay. So we make our first correction for the degree of anemia. That's done automatically. Okay. In this case, we did it with 3%. Okay, and so we look at the CBC slip, and we see nothing that says polychromasia. That's it. That's the corrected retic count. But let's say the CBC slip said polychromasia present. Then that means we have to make an additional correction. And so we just arbitrarily divide by 2, and so now all of a sudden, our corrected count is 1.5%. Is that a good bone marrow response? No. Can you see why the boards is interested in this, guys? The boards is interested in this because if you just stuck with this when in reality it was really this when you factor this out, then you would have gone in a totally different direction in working up your anemia and you've spent all this money. And that's why we're in our HMOs and PPO things right now, guys. We ordered too many tests. Okay? The classic physician in the United States, I know because I did most of the hematology as a pathologist. I've done thousands of bone marrows. So this is one area I'm very familiar with. And you can always tell a moron that's working up an anemia when you see the orders. B12 folate, ferritin, bone marrow exam, direct Coombs, osmotic fragility test. They're all down there. Hemoglobin electrophoresis. Anything that deals with red blood cells, it's there. That's an idiot. That's someone that thinks that the laboratory is going to make the diagnosis. They have no idea how to work it up. That's a lot of money, guys. It costs about $1,500 to do a bone marrow. And report it out and all that stuff. It's big time, not to mention the uncomfortableness of it. Huh? You've got to think. And so you don't do stuff like that. It's called shotgunning. Okay? That's the Sylvester Stallone. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay? Knocking everybody off. Okay? As opposed to apoptosis. One at a time. Dirty Harry. Okay? So Dirty Harry is apoptosis, Arnold and Sylvester are infarction, you know, big time cell necrosis. You know, 300 cells dead versus uno. Okay, all right. So that's why this is important. And they use the term polychromasia. When you see it, guys, that means you've got to make an additional correction. And sometimes the whole question rests on whether you recognize that. They think it's that important. Okay, so that's the point that I want to make there. Okay. What's this called? Reticulocyte. Can you see that with a right game sustain? No. What are those things? RNA filaments. You know what you want to say? Ribosomes. Ribosomes don't look like threads. Ribosomes look like dots. That's basophilic stippling. So when we talk about lead poisoning, coarse basophilic stippling, those are persistent ribosomes, not RNA filaments. When we have these little things that look like filaments, like worms, that's RNA. Okay, when we look at a CBC slip, there's diagnoses that actually can be made most of the time. The rule of 3 is pretty good, and that is if you multiply the hemoglobin times 3, it should roughly equal the hematocrit. So can you work backwards? So we had a 15% hematocrit for the previous example. What was the hemoglobin? 5. Okay, 5, that's correct. So that's a pretty important thing. There's something that's totally unrelated to this that I also do at this point because it's good to keep it with this because it's another rule of 3. So it has nothing to do with a CBC slip. Okay? And that is transfusion of packed, not whole blood, packed red blood cells. So here's the rule. For every unit of packed red blood cells you transfuse in a patient, you aim to increase the hemoglobin by 1 and the hematocrit by 3%. You with me? Here's your question on boards. Ready? Patient's got a 5-gram hemoglobin, was given 3 units of packed red blood cells. The following day, the hemoglobin 6, the hematocrit's 18. Is that an appropriate response? What should it have been? 8 with an hematocrit of 24. Now put your noggins on. Why wasn't it 8? The patient has a GI bleed, guys. The patient's bleeding. Please don't forget the obvious. The most common cause of anemia in the whole world is iron deficiency. The most common cause of iron deficiency is a GI bleed overall. So the most common reason why the hemoglobin and hematocrit don't go up after transfusion of red blood cells is you're losing blood, most commonly in the GI tract. Never forget that, please. If you were thinking of hemolysis, wrong. I mean, that's like 1 in 250,000 chance of having a hemolytic anemia related to transfusion. Forget it. Okay, no way. So it's most commonly due to a bleed. That's the reason. That's the reason. Okay. Reference intervals, forget. Hemoglobin electrophoresis is mainly used to detect different kinds of hemoglobinopathies, which we'll discuss. Okay, now we talked about red blood cell industries and indices. MCV is very important. Now, this is not MTV, guys. This is MCV. This is mean corpuscular volume. How big is the dude? Okay, is it a small dude, a normal dude, or a big dude? Okay. And what happens is the machine does this. Every red blood cell has to go through an aperture, and it sizes it. And then it takes an average. And this is the best way of classifying anemia. So you must know this. If the normal is 80 to 100, if the average MCV is less than 80, then they're by definition microcytic. And so your differential then is a microcytic anemia. Play odds, it's iron deficiency. If it's between 80 and 100 and you have an anemia, then they're normocytic anemias. If it's greater than 100, then they're macrocytic anemias. That's probably the simplest one because it's either B12 or folate deficiency. Okay, that is really simple. Now, but the problem with this, I said it was an average. What if you had small cells and large cells called dimorphic red blood cell population? What would the MCV be? Normal, that's right. It's kind of like this. Those blood gases, right? You have a primary, let's say you have a metabolic acidosis, and then you have a metabolic alkalosis, okay? What would the pH be? Normal. So you have a microcytic anemia as well as a macrocytic anemia. What would the MCV be? Normal. How could you have that? How could you, let's say, have an iron deficiency anemia and, let's say, folate deficiency? Well, it depends on whether you know where these things are reabsorbed. Iron's absorbed in the duodenum, folate is reabsorbed in the jejunum, and B12 is reabsorbed in the terminalium. So that means you have small bowel disease like celiac disease. When you have malabsorption, guys, that affects different areas of your small bowel. They're going to affect those things. So, for example, celiac disease, the most common cause of malabsorption, is involving the duodenum and the jejunum. Then obviously you're going to have a deficiency of iron and folate. You're going to have small cells and large cells. Let's say it's involving jejunum and terminalium. Okay, well then it would be B12 and folate deficiency. Okay, so it's possible to have two anemias at the same time in a normal MCV. Do they usually do that on boards? Nah. This is for second year medical students, this test. They don't get into something that bad. Now, today, to my knowledge, from what I've heard from students, since I don't sit down and take the test, they have not asked about RDW. That's too bad because it is very, very important. It stands for red blood cell distribution width. It basically is the machine looking at the RBCs that are coming through the aperture and saying, are they all uniformly small? Are they all uniformly normal? Or are they all uniformly macrocytic? Or is there tremendous differences in size? The RDW can detect whether there's a change in the size of these things. Okay. And it reports it as a number. Okay, so I'm going to give you an example. Let's say you have a microcytic anemia, RDW increased. Okay, so what do you know so far? It's microcytic, and the RDW is increased. What does that mean? That there's different sized microcytic cells. Okay? There's a difference in the sizes of these things. okay? Maybe got some small ones and maybe some normal ones. And the RDW is picking that up. Now, I want to ask you a question. Do you develop microcytic anemia overnight? Do cells all of a sudden, when you're deficient in iron, become microcytic? Do you think there's just some cheerleader that says, on the count of three, we are going to become microcytic. Are you ready? One, two, three, microcytic. No, 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 no. No, 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 no. Okay? You're normocytic before you become microcytic. So can you say it? When you have developing microcytic anemia, you're going to have some normocytic cells that haven't become microcytic yet, and then you're going to have some small ones. So there's going to be a size variation. And guess who picks that up? The RDW does. Matter of fact, any good hematologist knows, when they look at a CBC slip, this is the trick. You see a low MCV, and you see an increased RDW, it's iron deficiency. Period. That can't be thalassemia because that's genetic. They're all microcytic. Okay? Right off the bat, you can make a diagnosis of that. Okay? So I don't know whether that's a waste of time in telling you that because I don't know whether they've asked that yet. Anybody know? Anybody see the RDW at all on the exam? You've seen it? Part two, but not part one. If it's on two, then it could be on one. Okay. White blood cell counts, white blood cell count, platelet counts, platelet count. Well, nothing more to say on that one. Can you elaborate? No. Okay. You're being mean. No, I'm not. All right, I want you to look at this smear, please. Look at it. Are they all uniform in size? I just want to see how you guys see. Make sure that all the specks are out of your eyes. Is that small? Is that large? So what would the RDW be in this? High. Okay, good. I just wanted to see where you are. Okay, does these cells, anything look abnormal about these RBCs? No, well, yes, serocyte. Okay, that's good. Anything else? Target cell. Now, I like these two things because a spherocyte has too little membrane. And that's why it can't hold the biconcave disc. It's just a sphere. So it's too little membrane. A target cell has got too much membrane. God, look at this thing. It's got too much membrane. Now, you know what? Not the best way. That's an obese cell. That's an anorexic. Okay? Remember, the anorexics have way too low on their weight. So too little membrane. And so they can't hold the biconcave disc, they form a sphere. Okay. Target cell is an obese cell. Where do we get big when we eat too much? Right here. Right? Boop. All right. Comes out right in the middle. Same with a red blood cell. That's about right smack in the middle of that red blood cell. Bulging. It's got a little bit of waistline problem. And that's because the excess membrane bulges like this. So that means because it's bulged like this, there's more hemoglobin that can collect in there, and it makes it look like a bullseye. So I want you to remember this. A spherocyte is a what cell? An anorexic cell, too little membrane. A target cell is a what cell? It's an obese cell with too much membrane. Why is it important to recognize a target cell? Because they are markers for alcoholics, because it alters the cholesterol concentration in the membrane, and secondly, hemoglobinopathies. Things like thalassemia, and sickle cell, and hemoglobin C, and all those things always have target cells in it, so they're very, very important cells to know. Okay, lastly, for this morning, I want you to look at these cells here. Okay? These cells here. And I want you to look at these cells here. Now, this is what a mature red blood cell looks like. It looks like a biconcave disc. You see it? Okay? Notice not a hole in it. It's not like a donut. Okay? Donuts have holes in them. Okay? But it's thin there. Because it's thin there, there's less hemoglobin there. And it's more going to be concentrated at the edges. That's why you have a central area of power in a normal red blood cell when it's lying flat. Now, I want you to look at this and just get a feel for what is considered normal on this thing. This is kind of pushing it, this slide. I don't like this one totally. What is the matter with these things? Okay, just get a feel for that. Okay, what's considered normal? All right, I want you to look over here now. All right, let's pick that cell. Is that a normal area, central area of power, yes or no? No. How about that one? No. How about that one? No. Okay. You know what you just diagnosed? A microcytic anemia. Because all the microcytic anemias have one thing in common. They all have a decrease in hemoglobin synthesis. Does it make sense? If you don't have a whole lot of hemoglobin, then the redness of the cell is going to markedly, drastically decrease, and you're going to see a greater area of pallor. Is that agreed? So all of you, you don't even need the MCV. You knew by looking at that, by the fact that there's no hemoglobin in L cells, it was microcytic. And if you played odds, it's iron deficiency. So don't tell me you can't recognize these things on a peripheral smear on an exam. Yes, you can. Now, what did I say a spherocyte was? It was a cell that had too little membrane, and so it was a sphere. Look at that, please. You see a central area of pallor in that cell right there, that cell right there, that cell right there, that cell right there. Do you see an area of central pallor there? No. That means it must be a spherocyte. So don't tell me you cannot recognize spherocytosis, because there'll be little red cells, all red, no central area of pallor. And don't tell me that you're not able to recognize a microcytic anemia, because there'll be cells that have lots of blank, lots of pale color to them. You can hardly see the hemoglobin in them. Those are always the microcytic ones. So it's extremely easy for a medical student taking an exam to identify spherocytes, and extremely easy to recognize microcytic cells with hypochromia. And things like iron deficiency, chronic disease, that type of thing. Very easy. You just did it. Okay? That's enough for now. So this afternoon we'll finish off. I don't know if we'll finish hematology, but we'll get pretty close to it.